Hello, hello everyone. This is Sam again. Just give me one second. It's going to be my first time in the studio by myself, so hopefully, it'll go well and everything. So, let's see. So, at the top of every hour, we got our legal ID. So, I'm here at the WRFULP in Urbana, so just as a disclaimer, WRFU is an open forum for the Urbana-Champaign and our online community. Views expressed are those of our speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, UCIMC, or the Urbana Socialist Forum. All right, so with that in mind, hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. I'm your host, Sam Notla. Last time, we talked a bit about prison philosophy vis-a-vis the works of Foucault. Then we talked about some local prison issues in Illinois, specifically with regards to prisoner healthcare. Finally, we talked a bit about what you could do to help correct these injustices. And so today, we're going to get into our roadmap for this show. So this is going to be the first episode in a short series on prison literacy. So today, we're going to talk about prison literacy in general and some examples of how it's currently being impeded, in my opinion and the opinion of many others, as we'll get into some articles and everything, and why we should care about it from a cost-benefit standpoint, as well as from a personal moral one. Next week, what we're going to do is we're going to interview a jail librarian to get a personal perspective on the issue. There's someone who's been working firsthand with these guys in the prison. They have a much better personal view on prison literacy in general than I do, so I'm sure they'll have a lot of great material to talk about. And I hope you guys like what we have in store for you today. And so, to start with, let's lay a bit of a foundation with prison literacy in general, and then we'll get into current events. And the best way to get started with our foundation here is, the first term we're going to talk about is recidivism, all right? Basically, this is repeat offending. Specifically, it's if you get out of jail and then you get rearrested or reconvicted or returned to prison. Debatable on whether or not you actually do something wrong, which is on a case-by-case topic, but as long as we're just defining recidivism, it's just rearrested, reconvicted, or returned to prison. All right, so as far as that goes, as of 2016, nationally, they found that 83% of released prisoners are arrested again within 9 years. And that's pretty crazy, right? It basically means that 83% of the people that get out of jail will be back in the system within 9 years. In Illinois specifically, I found a statistic as of 2015 saying that we have a recidivism rate of almost 50% within 3 years. And so this is the three-year stat. I just gave the nine-year one because that's a longer time frame, but most of the studies here will talk about these three-year time frame. And so basically, similar to what we talked about earlier, this means that within 3 years, almost 50% of people who are released from prisons in Illinois will be back in the system, either being rearrested, reconvicted, or returned to prison. Federally, it's at 68%, so this 50% number is better, but it's still not good. You know, we shouldn't be proud of the fact that we're at almost 50% recidivism rate just because 68% is the federal standard for this three-year guideline. So here's the first material thing about recidivism, before we get into the moral kind of thing about it. If for purely from a cost-benefit analysis, this should worry you that we have this 50% rate in Illinois and 68% federally within 3 years. And this is because IDOC, the Illinois Department of Correction, they spend about $38,000 per inmate every year. It's the highest by far of any Midwestern state. I think Indiana's at like $18,000 or something like that. And Illinois' amount is also about 25% above the national average, which is about $31,000. These statistics are all per the Vera Institute, if you want to go ahead and verify it yourselves. They also have a bunch of great statistics on other things outside of Illinois. So, yeah, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, check them out. Anyways, so despite this expenditure, despite this $38,000 per inmate per year, half of people will go right back into the system within that three-year time frame. This tells us that our prisons are not really succeeding. They're not really rehabilitating the prisoners, and we're paying the price for this, right? Again, this is just from a cost-benefit analysis. And that's the thing, is that when you're spending $38,000 per inmate per year, you expect that the prisons invest in measures that keep them from increasing this recidivism rate, that keep them from being rearrested, reconvicted, or return to prison. And you could say, okay, this might be a high number, but they're doing their best. But my point with the rest of the episode is kind of to touch on prison literacy and why I don't think they're doing the best on that. All right, so that's the cost-benefit side of it as to why you should care. And here's the moral standpoint. I think the moral standpoint pretty much is pretty self-evident, but I'll kind of go into how I personally feel about it. So if you take up the viewpoint that people in prison have done something wrong, that's not something that I personally believe for everyone, but let's just say that you do, then we should especially value the rehabilitation aspect of prison, right? Because if they've done something wrong, you want to make sure that you can fix that wrong and make sure you can reintegrate them back into society and everything. And while it's easy to vilify prisoners for what they've done or what they've been accused of, the reality is that, you know, they're your neighbors, your brothers, your sisters, your fathers, your mothers, your children. The reality is that they're often driven to their crimes through the material situation that they find themselves in, not because they have some great love for destruction, whether that's material or morally. This isn't to say that everyone is innocent of everything, but it's just to say that I think that we could do a lot better job of understanding the fact that people aren't these abstract balls of chaos, and that's why they end up in prison or something. They're human beings who find themselves in certain situations, and a lot of the time, the situation lends a lot to their how they've ended up in prison and everything, rather than their innate humanity or their innate being. And I want to make that point with the fact that there are neighbors and so on and so forth, that they're not separate from society. You know, they might be in prisons locked up somewhere that you can't see them day to day, but they're not separate from your society, nor should they have to be separate from our society. There are very, very few individuals who are actually irredeemable, whose views are so irreconcilable with societies, who are actual quote-unquote lost causes, to the fact that I don't even think that they're worth bringing up in conversation. So I think that given the vast majority of prisoners, also this is just a stat that I think is important to keep in mind, half of prisoners I believe in Illinois are nonviolent drug offenders. So just keep that in mind when you think about your stereotypical idea of a prisoner being violent or anything like that. They're overwhelmingly not. So anyways, we should do well to remember that when rehabilitation fails, when the system fails, these prisoners and everyone, we fail as well, right? Because they're a part of our community, a part of our society, so we should feel this on, like, a gut level, right? That when they fall back into these behaviors, when they fall back into the system and everything, this is a moral calling that we have ourselves as citizens to fix these issues. And so now we've talked a little bit about recidivism. The question there is, where's the prison literacy aspect, right? Because this is the episode on prison literacy, the first one in a series of many. Well, we'll start with a landmark program called Changing Lives Through Literature, which is talked about in a Quartz article by Efrat Livni. In 1991, when a local judge saw high recidivism rates in his area, he was convinced by a literature professor by the name of Bob Waxler to test the humanizing effect of reading. What they found was that prisoners often connected with fictional characters, with fictional stories, developing empathy, hope, and friendship among the words of the book they were reading. They put themselves in the situations they were reading, whether they were the perpetrator themselves or the victim, the consequence, feeling the consequences of their actions. And the result was pretty startling. Recidivism in that pilot program was cut by 58%. The exact numbers were 45% in the control group to 19% in the reading group as to recidivism rates. And an analysis of more rigorous and modern studies analyzed by the RAND Corporation show that this relationship between correctional education programs, which include the literacy programs, of course, and recidivism has held well beyond the confines of the original program, with a 43% lower recidivism rate on average within that three-year time frame, which is the time frame I'm bringing up every time I talk about these rates now. And the reason that this study is important is it's saying, okay, that first one wasn't just like an outlier. It wasn't just some freak of nature thing. This has been well supported by multiple studies, by multiple correctional education programs throughout the U.S. and everything. Well, remember that $38,000 per inmate figure earlier that we spend here in Illinois on average? Well, we have $45,000 prisoners currently incarcerated in the IDOC system, and over 1.5 million nationally. Imagine how much you can save. I don't want to bore you with the exact number and a bunch of calculations after I've given you a bunch, but imagine how much you can save, both materially, cash-wise, and morally, when you reduce that recidivism rate by 43%. Furthermore, if you want like an actual material tag on it, each instance of recidivism in Illinois costs residents around $120,000 in criminal and justice social costs. It's not just some small number. This is like enough for someone who makes six figures. That's like their salary in a year. And that's each instance of recidivism in Illinois on average. And so that's a pretty startling number. So I think that if you're someone that's worried about the material side of this, and I think that it is an important part to be worried about, you should realize that it's not like small pocket change or anything. And so now what I want to do is I want to go back to what I mentioned earlier, right? About prisoners learning to empathize with their victims to find solace in stories, characters, and situations they can relate to. It, as part of this pilot program about reading to reduce recidivism. So literacy, in my opinion, goes even beyond that. Being able to read doesn't just allow you to step into new worlds, though this is no small feat or no small boon to people who are able to do that. It also allows you to create new worlds. It can inspire you with completely new ways of thinking. It can inspire you to write your own books, to espouse your own worldview on paper. It teaches you how to communicate, how to get a job, how to prepare for tomorrow. Basically, literacy can grant prisoners a tomorrow that they didn't have yesterday. They're given a future, a roadmap for what they can do after they're released from prison, for what they can do to develop their minds while they are in prison as well. Not that this isn't to say that they're doing nothing while they're in prison, but it's just the fact that we should do anything to kind of aid them to develop their mind, just as we should do with anyone. And so this is why we see reduced recidivism rates. It's not just because of this empathetic view and you get to step in a new world, although, again, these are insanely important aspects of it. It's the fact that it also gives you a platform by which you can start to create things. You have an example that you can follow. It's not just some small statistic, this recidivism number, that we should throw out in the context of dollars or whatever, because essentially what there is an incalculable moral benefit to granting our fellow human beings that tomorrow, that future, which goes far beyond any dollar amount, in my opinion. But as always, if everything always went well, there wouldn't really be any reason to have a show like this. Because in spite of all these clear benefits, in spite of these mountains of evidence, both material and moral, prison literacy efforts have been getting hacked and slashed left and right. Per an article by Lee Gaines of the Illinois Newsroom, IDOC spent, quote, roughly $750,000 each year on reading materials in the early 2000s. In 2017, that number was $276. If you normalize it per prisoner, that $276 amount, remember we spent $38,000 per prisoner in Illinois? Per prisoner, then, we allocate $0.006, or 0.6 cents, to reading materials. That's 0.6 cents in an area where recidivism rates can be lowered by 43% by any kind of substantial investment. To kind of put this more into perspective of like a medium household income, the median household income was a bit under twice that $38,000 amount, I believe, for like the last year. It was $62,000 or something like that. And could you imagine not spending more than a cent of your personal budget on something that has been proven to have such a profound impact on your life? And it's not like it's some unreasonable request either. Funding used to be at that $750,000 amount. It's not like it's some big number that has never been done before. And yet IDOC purposefully allocates money away from these programs, away from reducing recidivism, away from giving prisoners a tomorrow, in my opinion. And going back to the RAND report, that doesn't even make sense from a direct cost-benefit analysis. In the RAND report, what they actually found was that for every dollar spent on prison education programs, $5 are saved in reincarceration costs. And it's not even because of recent budget problems, if you're thinking, oh, well, IDOC might be part of this budget crisis and everything that was going on a few years ago. IDOC has actually been steadily reducing the amount they spend on reading materials for the last 17 years, well before any budget problem started. And that last 17 years of reduction, that's just where the figures started. And it's also not because IDOC didn't have a chance to explain themselves, because they refused to interview with the article writer who was talking about all this stuff. They didn't explain the drop-off in this funding when they were specifically asked to comment on it, and they specifically did not cite the budget crisis to explain this drop-off. And so that's just to say that I feel like we've covered the basis pretty well on whether IDOC has had some other circumstances that led to them reducing these their investment on prison literacy. And so on this topic of prison literacy in more of like an abstract form and just in Illinois itself, I'm going to stop myself for today. This isn't because I'm done with it at all. It's just because it's going to come up in future episodes, of course. And we'll bring it up then again, the same stories, the same stats and everything, but in a new analytical framework. But before I exit this section, I want to ask all of you to consider why IDOC does this. There is the one viewpoint that maybe there's just a bunch of circumstances they have to deal with, but I don't know those circumstances. So looking at it from more of a structural standpoint, I want you to ask yourself, why do they seem to purposefully hamstring prison literacy efforts when they clearly do not have to do so? Do they stand to benefit from high rates of recidivism? Does it reinforce our prison industrial complex? Is it a point of control over prisoners? And just remember from our last episode, when we talked about points of control between power structures and punishment systems, one of the big points from that show was that punishment systems aren't completely separate from the rest of society. And that is to say that the way the power structures control people in punishment systems like prisons and everything is also emblematic of the relationship that they have with you, even if you're someone who'll never be near a prison, will never be in a prison or anything, because it's the same kind of tactics that will be used in both cases. So again, that's just something to think about. And these are just some questions that you have to ask yourself within a litany of others. I want to be clear and just say that I don't think that you have to particularly answer yes to any of these. There are a lot of different opinions on why they do this. You can probably guess as to what my personal ones are, but I do think that these are valuable ones for anyone to reflect on. But for now, let's turn to some current issues. So I've somewhat recently been sent linked to these stories, which are based around a similar issue. And that issue is that prisoners are being issued free tablets and then finding that there are charges for materials and apps on the tablets themselves. So to begin with, these tablets aren't really of good quality. Cory Doctorow on a site called Boing Boing, funny name, and the Appalachian Book Project, both these groups independently wrote articles on the issue in West Virginia, where Doctorow called the tablets, quote, the flimsiest, cheapest, least reliable hardware imaginable. In West Virginia, the company Global Tellink, or GTL, has a contract with the West Virginia Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, wherein GTL provides the tablets and, well, you know, West Virginia Department of Corrections provides the prisoners and everything. And so that sounds really nice and altruistic and all, but as most of us know, things that sound too good to be true often are. So prisoners have to pay a 5 cent per minute charge to use most of the features on the tablet. Notably, the books on the tablet actually come completely free from Project Gutenberg's online library, a different organization completely from GTL. Project Gutenberg is a volunteer-run organization that aims to electronically publish any books that they legally can, meaning that they tend to be public domain, not be under copyright or anything. So basically, Project Gutenberg has been giving the public these books for free to read by publishing them electronically, but prisoners have to pay for it. And what that means is that GTL is using the work of a nonprofit volunteer organization and using it to make money, and exorbitant amounts of money as well. The Appalachian Prison Book Project actually does a really good calculation on this to kind of highlight how absurd it is. A new copy of George Orwell's 1984 is about $7.50. It takes about 11 hours to read if you read it about 30 pages per hour. Okay, so remember, it takes about 11 hours to read, and it's $7.50 new. At a 3 cent per minute rate, which is actually lower than the 5 cent per minute rate, that's because the 3 cent per minute rate is some kind of discount promotional rate that they're offering for a little bit before they go to 5 cent per minute. So that's why they do this calculation with 3 cent per minute. And so at a discounted 3 cent per minute rate, it costs $20 to read 1984. This isn't to own it or anything. This is just to read it straight. No breaks, no time to think, nothing. That's almost three times as much as if you literally went out and bought a new copy. And remember that this is provided for free by Project Gutenberg in the first place. But that actually, it gets even worse, because the thing that a lot of us forget about is just how little prisoners make. In West Virginia, prisoners make about 30 cents per hour on average. That means that they would need to work for 66 hours to have enough money to read one book. And I think that my next statement stands on its own. That's insane. That's like a week and a half of a full 40-hour work week just to read one book, to have enough money to read one book straight without time to reflect or anything. And so not only has West Virginia's system somehow commodified free knowledge, but they've done it to such a perverse degree that any rational person could look at it and be horrified. And yet the system is being championed by GTL as free to taxpayers and prisoners in a concerted effort to misinform the public about what's really going on in prisons. And it doesn't just stop at the books. Music, games, e-messaging, and e-books cost 5 cents a minute. Video visitation is 25 cents a minute. Instant messaging is 25 cents a minute, billed to friends and family outside. Sending a photo would be 50 more cents on top of that, and a video is a dollar. So that's a lot of numbers, so I want to recontextualize it for you. Remember that for all these numbers, we're looking at that average wage of 30 cents per hour. So to send a minute-long video, you have to work for 3.5 hours. To have a video visitation with your family for just 30 minutes, you need to work for 25 hours. And I do know that all of you, or a lot of you, are probably thinking at this point, 30 cents per hour is a crazy low wage, and I completely agree with you on that. We're not going to touch too deeply on that right now. We'll do that at a later time, just so that if anyone has any concerns about me bringing that up and thinking it's normal, I don't think it's normal. It's just the reality of the situation right now. And so the question becomes, why does West Virginia's Department of Corrections allow any of this? And as usual, what happens is that profit plays its dirty role. West Virginia's Department of Corrections gets 5% on all revenue, which incentivizes such a system in the first place. And not only this, it incentivizes them to do, and this has actually happened in other states, it incentivizes them to reduce prisoner accessibility to in-person books, in-person visits, and educational opportunities even further. So the point is that they actually reduce the accessibility of prison literacy efforts to prisoners because they can't make money off of most of that, but they get a cut off of this revenue, so they have an incentive to do it. If we're talking about profit motives and everything, this is what they're incentivized to do. And companies will actually lobby prisons to do this, notes Dr. Rao in his article. And so I want you to think for a second, does this kind of seem familiar to what IDOC has been doing in a sense? Because it should. Does it seem like these efforts will increase recidivism, increasing the profit potential of prisons, especially in a scenario where they can make money off of prisoners having access to educational materials? Because it should. And this isn't to say that IDOC is the exact same thing as West Virginia's Department of Corrections, but rather that there are alarming parallels that we can draw between these two situations, and it's something to keep an eye out for because these things do tend to spread, and we should worry about whether or not IDOC will get into a similar situation with these companies and whether or not they're already currently having this attitude against prison literacy for these reasons. And yet, this isn't an isolated incident. Sorry. In New York, a company called JPay has done virtually the same thing, but with even higher rates. There's an excellent article in The Outline by Michael Waters that details the issue in New York. JPay doesn't just use the cents per minute model or anything. You know, all they do is they jack up the prices to insane amounts because prisoners have nowhere else to go for content. Waters notes in his article, on JPay, a single song can cost as much as $2.50, and a complete album might be listed at $46 at exorbitant rates well beyond the market price. Books and content that are public domain, like many works of Shakespeare and Jane Austen, have price tags as well. Nothing is for free, even though these are public domain, so they should be free. And as seems to be this weird predatory trend, they are again using the free services of Project Gutenberg to turn a profit. And at this point, you start to like really feel bad for these guys at Project Gutenberg, because they're basically doing all this stuff so that people can read these great books for free and everything, and they're kind of being taken advantage of. And it's not like they're complicit in this or anything. I think there was something where their vice president or someone was saying that they were looking into these things. They aren't sure that they can actually do anything about it, but they're not happy that their stuff is being used in this kind of a system. And also, this thing with JPay, it doesn't just come out of nowhere, as bad as that would be. It's actually even worse, because JPay originally said that some things on the tablet would be free. But as I said earlier, everything has a price. So they've essentially completely lied about the situation to prisoners and people, since they're dealing with a population that has no avenue for recourse. Like, what are prisoners going to be able to say about it, right? Yet JPay wasn't able to just do whatever they want. That's like the silver lining of this. Because of mounting pressure by articles, citizens, journalists, and etc., they actually decided to end up making all ebooks free, you know, as they should have been in the first place. But the other thing is, that's just ebooks. Games that are free outside the prison system are still on JPay's marketplace at jacked up rates. And I urge people to not look past that just because it's games or anything. Because I think that everyone deserves to have avenues for relaxation and rest. I see no reason that we should punish prisoners for trying to have that small reprieve, especially when there's no cost to it, except for the one artificially imposed by people trying to make a quick buck off the desperate. Again, these games are free outside the prison and everything. Prisoners have no other choice, realistically. Like, imagine yourself in that situation. You'd be likely willing to pay whatever you had to for the opportunity to read a book or play a couple of games, you know, even if that meant working over a full work week in order to do so. And so even these two situations aren't the extent of where companies like GTL and JPay have reached. Even just if you do a cursory Google search, an article by Tanya Riley reveals that prisoners are being exploited by JPay in Ohio, GTL in Indiana, and their reach goes on and on. And if the prison switches off of something like JPay after you bought stuff on their tablets, well, tough luck if you're a prisoner. That's all gone now. When Florida Corrections switched off of JPay, inmates lost $11.3 million in music downloads. So you don't even own the stuff that you bought if you're a prisoner here. You know, not only is free not really free, but paid isn't even paid. Companies like JPay make millions, and yet prisoners can easily have nothing to show for that. And so now, if nothing else, I hope that these stories reveal to you some new injustices in our prison system. These prison systems commodify knowledge when it should be free and open to those who seek it. If you disagree with that sentiment, I hope you would at least agree that it should not be paywalled without reason, if projects like Gutenberg are releasing these things for free. Even when there is overwhelming evidence that certain programs or materials would help rehabilitate prisoners, to help reintegrate them into our communities, prisons often choose not to support them, like what we were talking about with prison literacy earlier. And the reason isn't that they're unaware of the desire for these programs, nor because they're unaware of the benefits of these programs. Because you can bet anything that if we can find this stuff out on a simple internet search, on a simple Google search, the people in charge of prisons have known it for much longer. And one reason for why this scenario has come about is a simple, lamentable fact. In the prison system, profit is king. And you don't even need private prisons to do it, though let me be clear, I believe that private prisons are much worse and are much more incentivized to do so. The things I'm talking about are happening in state-run prisons, prisons which should have to answer to everyday people like you and I. And when it comes to profit, when you have an exploitable and separated class of people like prisoners, it's very easy to milk them for all they're worth without most people being any the wiser. And it's easy to set up a cycle that not only does not combat recidivism, but that actively promotes recidivism. It's also probably part of a bigger concerted effort that even when people do know about these kinds of things, a good amount think that the prisoners deserve their situation anyways, just by virtue of being in a prison, when I don't believe that any person does. Because so often, we do vilify prisoners. We do it in media, in stories, in the workplace, in conversation, even in exploitatory jokes about things as serious as prison rape. We judge them despite not understanding why they are where they are, their personal situations, journeys, and trials. We take individuals and we lump them all into this odd mold that we have of a prisoner who's violent and deserves to be in there. And in doing so, we easily dehumanize them ourselves, right, when we do all these things, when they're just as crucial a part of our community as we are. What we should do as concerned citizens is to call out these actions when we see them, put pressure on prison systems like IDOC in Illinois, and on legislators. We should support groups like Project Gutenberg and decry ones like JPay and GTL. If you hear that IDOC wants to get involved with them, with JPay and GTL, let them know that you'll give them hell if they do, because this is something that I think is worth fighting for. And now for some parting thoughts. I want you to think about how these kinds of relationships happen. How these relationships happen between prisons and profit, about how companies will rise to leech off of exploited groups in whatever way they can. I want you to think about any connections you can find between these stories and maybe your own everyday lives. After all, what I stressed in the first show was how punishment systems inevitably affect us as well, even if none of us ever go near a prison. Maybe you can think about how certain parts of your lives are commodified when they shouldn't be, when certain people or groups seek to extract profit from you when they have no right to. And as always, think about how in those ways, you and the guy or gal behind bars might not be that different after all. And so, just as some wrap-up, next week we're going to interview a jail librarian to get his thoughts on prison literacy and his personal experience working in, well, you know, a jail library. In later episodes, we'll revisit this topic for a bit, and then we'll talk about other ones, like the exclusion of certain LGBT materials from federal prison spaces, again, with that prison literacy spin. If you have any thoughts, comments, concerns, or whatnot, send them to prisonjusticeshow@gmail.com. Again, that's prisonjusticeshow@gmail.com. And I'll see you next time.
If I could fix this damn mower, I'd mow the damn...